call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order, March 26th. Appreciate the full hearing room, and I believe there are other people watching our activities today. We have an informational meeting on Lower Columbia River fish management, and as some opening comments, I want to acknowledge for the benefit of everyone here, this is an issue that I don't know as much about as a lot of you do. Our intent today is to get a sense of the background, a sense of the various perspectives on what is certainly an issue that provokes strong feelings. We have, as many of you probably know, a series of panels that are going to present different perspectives and backgrounds on the issue. It's our intent as a committee to take that information in and to get a sense of all of the background. We've worked hard to make sure that all the different perspectives are represented, and in keeping with that and our relatively tight timeline, there are some pretty specific time limits that those who are presenting are aware of. So I just wanted to make sure that the folks who are presenting know that timeline remains. You're welcome to present as you would like during that time. I'm going to be fairly strict, and I let all the committee members know this as well, that we're going to stick to the timeline. So even if there are questions remaining for the various panel, I'm going to stick to it so that everybody gets a chance to present. Those who are presenting, you're welcome to cut your testimony off a little bit early if you'd like to accommodate more questions, but I'm going to stick to the timeline. So with that, I'm happy to get underway and ask Kurt Melcher and Steve Williams to come forward from the Department of Fish and Wildlife to get us underway. While you're getting settled, I should also acknowledge and welcome Representative Edwards, who's taken an interest in this, I think, partly because of his service on Ways and Means subcommittees that are relevant, and glad you're here. Please feel free to participate as a member of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have with me here today Mr. Steve Williams, who is our Assistant Fish Division Administrator. Mr. Williams is primarily responsible for ocean fishery and Columbia River fishery management and the programs therein. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and we wanted to, I'll speak very quickly. We have about 20 slides. I'll move quickly through them, hoping that we have some time for questions. We wanted to give you, upon your invitation, Representative Reed, the opportunity, or thanking you for the opportunity to present an overview of some of these Columbia River fisheries, where they occur geographically, some very high-level overview of stock status and harvest in these fisheries, as well as some of the management forms that we work on and work with within the Columbia River. So with that, a quick overview then.
Could you move the microphone just a little bit closer? We're having trouble picking up on the...
No problem. Thank you. I just didn't want to be too close.
Yeah, there's always a fine line.
Thanks. So, brief overview then. We'll give you a short discussion of the fishing areas of the Lower Columbia River, some stock status information, fishery management forms that we work in, also with a tie to the Endangered Species Act and the numerous listed stocks and species we have in the Lower Columbia River, and a short discussion of current harvest levels. This figure displays essentially the lower 300 miles of the Columbia River with the and the primary fishing areas. So on this figure, from the mouth at the Pacific Ocean upstream to Bonneville Dam is the primary commercial fishing area. Bonneville Dam's at River Mile 146. The commercial deadline is at Beacon Rock, which is River Mile 140. And the commercial fishery occurs throughout that reach, although subject to management annually based on stock status and other factors. The Treaty Indian fishery, both commercial and subsistence and ceremonial fisheries, occur above Bonneville Dam, from Bonneville Dam upstream to McNary Dam, as well as in tributaries to the Columbia, both on the Oregon and Washington side. And then the recreational fishery occurs throughout the reach, from the Pacific Ocean at the mouth upstream to and above McNary Dam as well, as in the tributaries. On this figure, the green stars at the left-hand side of the lower river indicate the select area fisheries that we currently have in place, which are some off-channel commercial fishing opportunities that that are currently implemented. And this figure is basically a highlight of those areas, or that shows them in more detail. So you're looking at the extreme lower 25 miles of river here with the Astoria Megler Bridge. You'll see Young's Bay, Tongue Point South Channel, Blind Slough, Napa Slough, and then on the Washington side, the upper piece of the graph, the Deep River Select Area Commercial Fisheries. I wanted to talk a little bit about some stock status, returns to the Columbia. Again, it's very high level, but looking at the last 20 years of spring Chinook returns to the Columbia River, we see a range of run sizes from in well under 100,000 to the peak, and actually a modern-day record of 2001 where we had over 500,000, almost 550,000 spring Chinook return to the Columbia River. And in 2009, our forecast is about combined about 350,000 spring Chinook. Also of interest on this graph and graphic are the two federal listings that occurred in 1992 of Snake River spring Chinook and Upper Columbia River spring Chinook, which were listed in 1999. And you'll see that in 2001 we did reopen fisheries, marked selective fisheries for hatchery Chinook during the spring after what amounted to as a two-decade or more closure. Minimum summer Chinook run size returning to the Columbia River. Through the 1990s, we saw poor returns, which had been the case since actually the mid-1960s. And in the early 2000s, we've seen quite a rebound in this population, and we have reopened and reinitiated both recreational and commercial fishing opportunity in the main stem Columbia for the first time since the mid-1960s. Next figure displays the minimum fall Chinook run size entering the Columbia River. Again, this is a composite of multiple stocks. It shows the period through the 1990s where we were fairly stable and not extremely robust populations in the 200 to 300,000 range, and then quite an increase in the early 2000s and through the rest of this decade, what we would consider as average or better returns of fall Chinook. Again, on this figure, we highlight that the Snake River stock were listed in 1991, and the Lower Columbia River stocks were listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act in 1999. The figure for Columbia River coho returns shows, again, the very poor returns particularly in the mid-1990s, but for the most part of that decade, with returns to the Columbia River of as low as 100 to 200,000 fish. And then through the 2000s here, we've seen fair improvement with 400 to 500,000 fish annually returning to the Columbia. We have a forecast for 2009 of about 1 million, a little over 1 million fish, which would be the second highest return in the last 20 years. Again, highlighting on this graph, the Lower Columbia River natural coho were listed under the State Endangered Species Act in 1999 and were then listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act for protection in the year 2005. Summer steelhead returns to the Columbia River Basin through the 1990s were relatively stable and in the 200,000 fish range. Through the 2000s here, again, we've seen very stable returns and generally between 300,000 and 400,000 summer steelhead returning to the Columbia River. Of note on this graph, Snake River and Upper Columbia River stocks were listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1997, and Mid-Columbia River stocks were listed in 1999 under the Federal Endangered Species Act. I wanted to talk a little bit about the fishery management forums that we work in, the state and the agency. We have coursework in the USB Oregon Management Forum. We work in what's referred to as the Pacific Fishery Management Council. I'll go into a little bit more details on each of these in a minute, as well as the Columbia River Compact. USB Oregon was a court ordered, was a district court ruled in 1969 that the Treaty Indians were entitled to a fair and equitable share of the harvest in the Columbia River. As a result of that district court ruling, the first management agreement was adopted as court order in 1988. That was a 10-year agreement. We operated from through the 1990s on a series of shorter-term interim management agreements, and then after a lengthy process with the tribes and the federal government, we reached a new Columbia River Fish Management Agreement in 2008. That was adopted as court order in 2008, which lasts and runs for the next 10 years through 2017. The scope of the agreement was initially designed or directed at rebuilding weak salmon and steelhead runs, and has also evolved into providing guidance not just for harvest decisions and harvest sharing and rebuilding runs, but also for fish production efforts in the upper basin. Parties to the U.S. versus Oregon agreement, states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho through their respective fish and wildlife agencies, four Columbia River Treaty tribes, the Umatilla tribe, Warm Springs, Nez Perce, Yakima tribes. We have the Shoshone-Bannock tribe of Idaho, also party to the agreement, National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Pacific Fishery Management Council, then, is one of eight regional fishery management councils that were created by the Magnuson-Stevens Act, or the Magnuson Act in the mid-1970s, now the Magnuson-Stevens Act. It's one of eight regional fishery management councils. The Pacific Fishery Management Council is responsible for managing ocean fisheries off of Oregon, Washington, and California. The council also manages on a stock-specific basis for Columbia River stocks, which are of interest to in-river fisheries as well as in-river tribal interests. So the ocean fisheries are managed to integrate and coordinate with the needs of the in-river fisheries.
Just as a time check here, yep. We've passed 10 minutes, so we have about 10 minutes left.
And I should be on track.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. The Columbia River Compact was created in 1915 by the states of Oregon and Washington to regulate Columbia River commercial fisheries. They recognized the need to do that in a coordinated fashion, not to have both states regulating similarly. The compact, as required under the U.S. Constitution, was ratified by Congress in 1918, and it's been in place since that time. The compact is comprised of the Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife Commissions, and the commissions have delegated their authority, their decision-making authority, and their negotiation authority through the agency directors. So through all these management forums, we have now, over the last decade, clearly a new player in the forums, if you will, and that is in the terms of the Endangered Species Act. I mentioned in my previous discussions that we now have Chinook, sockeye, and steelhead populations listed throughout the Columbia River Basin. Coho were listed in 2005. Green sturgeon were listed in 2006. Lower Columbia River smelt are proposed for listing this year. And basically every river system in the Columbia River Basin has some listed species present. Through the management forums and our agreements with the tribes, we have defined what the non-Indian harvest impacts can be on a variety of stocks. So, for instance, on spring Chinook, the non-Indian fishery impacts range between 0.5% and 2.7% of returning wild fish. It's a sliding scale based on run size. Similarly, for summer Chinook, sliding scale, again, based on run size of returning fish. Fall Chinook, again, sliding scale based on abundance with a range of impacts between 1.5% and 15% of returning fish. And steelhead and sockeye with a fixed impact rate of 2.5%. 0 and 1.0% respectively. I want to talk very briefly about some of the harvest reforms that have gone on over the last two decades. Generally speaking, in general, we've reduced harvest rates on all stocks in the Columbia River Basin. We've utilized extensively time, area, and gear regulations and restrictions to focus fisheries on given stocks or stock complexes. And most recently, we've begun using run size buffers, which essentially we're holding a portion of our ESA allowed impacts aside as a buffer for any management error or run size prediction errors. Specifically with regard to the commercial fishery, we've adopted mark selective regulations, that is, only hatchery fish can be retained. We've developed new fishing gear and new fishing techniques that allow for the release, the live capture and release of these fish. Included in these regulations are the use of tangle nets, recovery boxes, short nets and drift times, use of steelhead excluders, mandatory training for all fishermen, and onboard monitoring by State of Oregon and Washington staff. We've utilized extensively large mesh gear regulations to minimize the impact and avoid steelhead in some fisheries. And then on the recreational fishery side, we've adopted for many fisheries, both spring chinook, coho, and steelhead, mark selective regulations, which require that the angler releases any unmarked non-adipose fin clipped salmon or steelhead. We'll go very quickly through these harvest slides and hopefully save a little bit of time for questions. One of the questions we hear continuously over the last month or 2 months in this building were, what are the harvest numbers? Who's catching what fish? Where are the fish caught? So we've tried to show in this series of slides where the harvest of, in this case, Columbia River Spring Chinook takes place. Where does the harvest occur? And so you see a stacked bar which shows the two red or brown tones are select area commercial fisheries. Those are those off-channel commercial fisheries that I referred to in earlier slides. And the brown color, the Columbia River commercial fishery, with the light blue and the dark blue being Columbia River recreational and Columbia River tributary fisheries. So moving back to that spring chinook figure, you'll see tributary fisheries are a very large component within the basin, as are main stem recreational fisheries, and these select area commercial fisheries are a relatively small component, although very meaningful for the commercial fishery. Moving on then to summer chinook harvest, same color schemes, shows tributary harvest in dark blue, main stem recreational harvest in light blue, and main stem commercial harvest in the tan color. You'll see the select area commercial harvest in red, but there essentially are no impacts in those fisheries, which is why they don't appear on this figure. Harvest of fall chinook, you see things start to evolve a little bit here. You see that tributary fisheries are a much smaller component, tributary recreational fisheries. Main stem harvest of fall chinook even when combined with tributaries, is much more equal between the two harvest sectors, whether they be commercial or recreational. And the select area commercial fishery harvest is a much smaller component of the overall harvest. And lastly, the harvest of coho salmon in tributary and mainstem fisheries. Again, like the fall chinook picture, you'll see quite a bit more equal sharing between the sectors, if you will, on commercial and recreational harvest. A large proportion of the commercial harvest occurs in the select areas. So those select areas I referred to earlier are a very large component of the Columbia River commercial coho harvest. So just briefly then, to summarize these harvest slides, these harvest levels that we've been reviewing reflect largely the commission policy and policy decisions and guidance that both the Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife Commissions have adopted over the years. They also reflect Endangered Species Act constraints that have limited fisheries for all parties. And lastly, as a function of those constraints, we have a high demand for a limited resource. And this has led to, as you all, I think all are aware, a very intense debate and conflict over who catches fish where and when. In an effort to try and, over the last several years, an effort to try and resolve some of that conflict, the Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife Commissions have both tried to bring parties together. I think over the last 7 or 8 years of very contentious debates, sometimes quite negative in terms of the relationships that developed as a result of those discussions, the commissions wanted to try something different. All the constituents told us the same thing. They said, hey, we need to do something different here. We need to try and minimize the conflict. So the commission convened a series of stakeholder processes beginning in November of 2007, the first process through February of 2008. The purpose of the process was to develop a future vision and a workable plan for harvest allocation in the main stem Columbia. That process, and they had a timeline, where we had a timeline of concluding by February of 2008, because the commissions each were faced with an upcoming allocation decision. By February of 2008, the stakeholders had not resolved and come to any consensus in what a recommendation should be to the commission. The constituents did, though, agree on one thing. They agreed that they had learned a lot and they wanted to continue the process. So we continued the process then. They also agreed that they wanted to add some stakeholders. They wanted to add some conservation groups to the stakeholder process. So we continued the process with the Lower Columbia River Salmon Fishery Stakeholder Group, which then convened in March through May 2008. That process, for a variety of reasons, broke down, and the commissions continued with a commission populated, if you will, Columbia River Fish Working Group that convened and met during September through November of 2008. Their purpose was to develop a consensus recommendation just focused on spring and summer Chinook fishery management. And that concludes my presentation. I've been talking as fast as I could. I apologize for that. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. And you left us 15 seconds for questions. I suspect I will be saying this a lot today. I wish we did have time to ask you questions. But as I said, I want to keep to the schedule here and keep coming with the various perspectives. So thank you very much for getting us started with the background information. Next up is the Coastal Conservation Alliance. So I invite Steve Smith, Bruce Pauley, and Dave Shamp forward, and I will start the clock when you're sitting down. Okay.
Gentlemen. Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Need a microphone?
That would help.
Just a point of clarification, we're here representing the Coastal Conservation Association.
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
Association rather than alliance. There are a lot of acronyms in this
That's
building.
That's quite all right.
And if you could start by identifying yourself for the record, that'd be great, too.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Shamp. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Coastal Conservation Group here, representing about 4,000 members. I actually live in Cornelius, Oregon. The right of me is Bruce Pauley. Bruce is the vice chair of our Government Relations Committee and lives in Sherwood. And to my left is Steve Smith, and Steve resides in Canby, Oregon. I suppose that's obvious that we all reside in Oregon, right? And I'm going to start out by handing the microphone over to Mr. Smith to make a presentation to you regarding the science, the current science and thinking when it comes to fisheries on the Lower Columbia River. Mr. Smith is an independent scientist. He's a former federal agency biologist, a consultant with the Colville Tribe, and a member of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, the HSRG. And my understanding is they're ready to make a presentation in Portland tomorrow afternoon as well. I should point out that Mr. Smith is not here to advocate for the passage of any specific legislation, but I'm sure that you'll find his presentation very informative and relevant to the matters before us here today. Steve.
Thank you. I'll get right into it. I am a member of the Columbia River Hatchery Scientific Review Group. This is a body that was established by Congress. We started our work in 2006. We examined 178 different hatchery programs throughout the Columbia Basin and reviewed 351 salmon steelhead populations. Our job was to provide recommendations to the fishery managers on how they might be able to reform their hatchery operations and their harvest to better meet their conservation and their sustainable harvest objectives. As mentioned, tomorrow is our formal rollout of our product, our report. It is available to the public on the website there shown. What you'll see if you go to that website, there'll be kind of a summary congressional report. The main report is the system-wide report. I believe it's over 1,000 pages of recommendations, findings on it, the individual hatcheries and the populations, and some other system-wide recommendations. Before I get into the harvest reform recommendations, a little bit on the hatchery. What the group found is that hatchery reforms can make substantial contributions to the recovery of wild salmon and steelhead populations. And one of the main findings and relevant to the topic today is one of the main things we thought that the managers needed to do was to limit the numbers of hatchery fish on the spawning grounds, thereby increasing the productivity and the fitness of those wild stocks. And I say in most cases, there's obviously when the runs get very low, we need hatchery fish on the spawning grounds just to preserve the populations. Some of the key hatchery reform findings. First of all, we discovered that hatchery reform alone was not enough to meet the manager's conservation and harvest objectives. We found that harvest reforms are also needed to meet both, again, conservation and harvest. And without harvest reforms, without changes to harvest, the only way we could achieve the needed conservation objectives to get these species off the endangered species list was for very significant reductions in hatchery production, and that would be damaging both to the sport and recreational sport and commercial fisheries. Excuse me. The only other way to avoid the conflict of the hatchery fish with the wild populations was to construct expensive weirs at the mouths of most of the tributary streams. So the harvest reforms, generally speaking, what we found is we needed fewer hatchery fish on the spawning grounds, we needed more wild fish on the spawning grounds, and that harvest managers, our recommendations were for them to not only manage for escapement quantity, numbers of fish on the spawning grounds, but the quality of that escapement. And what we found is it's important proportionally to have a lot more wild fish in that spawning population than hatchery fish if you want to improve the fitness of these populations. Our specific harvest reforms, mass marking of hatchery fish destined for harvest. Again, some fish are raised for conservation purposes, those you do not want to mark. The typical mark is what they call an adipose fin clip. HSRG also recommended more selective fishing for the non-tribal fisheries in the ocean and in freshwater. We recommended moving more hatchery of the production. Most of this production is released in tributary streams, and we recommended moving more of this production into what we call the terminal fishing sites. Kurt showed those to you, the safe fisheries. And then definitely more research on developing selective fishing gears for the commercial fishery. Our conclusions is that reforms to the current hatchery and harvest efforts could make substantial contributions to recovery. We found that we could actually increase harvest and make them more sustainable by reforms to hatchery and harvest. And one key factor is we were a science group, independent science group. We did not look at our recommendations from a policy or legal point of view. There's plenty of other bodies to do that. So getting into some of the specifics here about the power of selective fishing, this graph here shows on the vertical axis the number over here. This kind of shows the number of marked hatchery fish you can harvest for every single wild fish or unmarked fish that you might kill in a selective fishery. And along the horizontal axis down here, that's the proportion of your run of salmon, spring Chinook, fall Chinook, that is marked. Typically, this is the ratio of hatchery fish in the run. And typically, you can be around 70% of a run can be marked hatchery fish. And then what the curves represent are different levels of release mortality from the gear. This is the mortality to the wild fish that you're not targeting that you want to release. And just as an example here, at 70% mark rate, if you have a 20% release mortality, that's the little green line down here, 70%, you can harvest 12 hatchery fish for every wild fish that you kill. If you go to 5%, the pink line, at a 70% rate, you can harvest 47 hatchery fish for every wild fish that's killed. And finally, if you can develop gear that has a 1% release mortality to the non-target wild fish, at this rate of hatchery fish in the run, you can harvest over 230 hatchery fish for every wild fish killed. And so obviously, following this generic relationship, there's great power in selective fishing for both increasing harvest and protecting wild fish for recovery. The other main recommendation was moving some of the existing fish to the safe fisheries. These are just data for the spring Chinook fisheries. 83% of the harvest in the safe fisheries comes from the fish released from the net pens in those areas. So it's very much a known stock fishery. 91% of the fish that are released from those net pens are harvested. And that's always a good efficiency issue for improving harvest. And finally, they can harvest these fish in the safe areas with very little impact on the listed upriver runs, just a fraction of a percent. So there's not a lot of conflict here with the listed stocks. For example, on the coho fisheries, 80 to 88% of the harvest comes from the net pen releases, and less than 1% of the harvest of coho in these safe areas are from coho arising from above Bonneville Dam. And these are typically the fish released from the tribal programs, which you don't want to be intercepting in the lower river. The other nice feature about the safe fisheries and the rearing program is the distribution of harvest from the net pen releases. The adult fish, you can see the percentages there. These fish contribute not only to the safe fisheries, but to ocean and lower Columbia River fisheries. So a lot of harvest potential, very little conflict with wild stocks. Adaptive management, I believe, is the key at this point for our fisheries and our recovery. We must allow the fish to readapt to their historical habitats. Our years of allowing too many hatchery fish on the spawning ground has weakened their fitness. And these fish must be allowed to adapt as the habitat changes, and we are going to see habitat changes mainly due to climate changes. Fish managers and the entities that fund their hatcheries, the Bonneville Power Administration, utilities, need to put the funds forth to reform these programs based on the scientific findings. And finally, fisheries need to adapt to the new science as well in circumstances.
I'm going to give you the same time check I did the department. We're just passing 10 minutes.
That's fine. One quick example I'll give here. I do consulting for the Colville tribes up in north central Washington. They have a lot of the problems, and more so than we have in the fisheries downriver. Their fish have to pass through 9 main stem dams. They've got habitat problems. They are altering their hatchery programs to not only meet but exceed the HSRG standards for hatchery reform. And they've started a program, a 10-year program in selective fishing. And what I'd like to show you here quickly is their results from the first year of that 10-year program. They've tried tangle nets where they get a 20% release mortality on the wild fish. And for those in the audience, they're gill netting in low to high 60-degree water. And they're still able to limit their release mortalities to 20%, which is still fairly high. They tried beach seines with a release of the wild fish of 1%. This is putting out a beach seine in a holding pool in the Okanagan River, and the subsequent catch from that fishery, they release the wild fish over the top of the net and keep the hatchery fish for consumption. And they've tried a modified purse seine, another gear, and what they're finding is no release mortality. And so if you refer back to that graph I showed of 1%, what you can do with 1% mortality, they're finding harvesting techniques that, in fact, can meet those high levels of compatibility. This is a modified gillnet boat from the lower river, modified to a purse seiner. This is the Columbia River off the mouth of the Okanagan. This is the skiff putting out the purse seine. You see the sport boats trolling in the background. The purse seine is brought in. The fish are active in this picture, but they do calm down. And then these are the researchers releasing the wild fish over the net and keeping the hatchery fish for consumption. In 2010, they're going to study. They plan to study what's called a pound net. This is a classic trap situation that used to be used a lot in the Lower Columbia. They feel again they can harvest a great deal of fish at no release mortality. So the harvest future, wrapping up here, we can recover salmon faster and with greater certainty with hatchery and harvest reform. We can make the harvest pie bigger and the allocation shares greater if we reform our hatchery and harvest practices. And in, I won't get into the caution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have 7.5 minutes for me.
Thank you, Steve. I want to point out the CCA, the Coastal Conservation Association, is here as an advocate for the fish. That's our focus. And we believe that what is good for the fish is good for all concerned, whether they be a commercial interest, recreational interest, activists, everybody. What's good for the fish is good for us all. And we also believe that the best science is key when we're making decisions regarding these fish. Thus, the reason for having Steve here today to present the latest and greatest science. Clearly, the information that he presented demonstrates the need to make changes in the management of our fisheries and to adapt to the current condition. The science shows, clearly shows, that selective harvest is a critical element to recovering the wild ESA stocks. The graph that Steve showed with that almost straight up curve in there showing what can be achieved when we reduce or eliminate the mortality for these wild fish has to be impressive. And I want to point out that that's the focus of House Bill 2597. The current law restricts the use of certain gear when it comes to harvesting salmon on the Columbia River. The only tool that can be used today legally is a gill net. That is not a selective way to harvest our fish. What House Bill 2597 does is open the door for the use of selective gear when it comes to commercially harvesting these fish. House Bill 2597 would require that the Fish and Wildlife Commission ensure that natural stocks, those wild fish, and the genetic diversity that comes with those fish is protected. House Bill 2597 also... Am I getting the wrong number?
Yeah.
Excuse me. 2579. All that way.
Many of us are in favor of transportation investments, too. So that's fine.
Turn my glasses upside down. My apologies. Let me get it right now. 2579 would also change the food fish policy to require that anadromous fish be managed to protect those wild stocks by reducing the straying of the hatchery fish, and that harvest would take place using that selective gear. Now, I want to make it very clear that CCA supports a commercial fishery. We're not out to eliminate the commercial fishery, but we believe that commercial fishery needs to be done in a selective way. That's where we're at on this thing. Again, with the focus on protecting those fish. We're not out to steal jobs. We're not out to ruin people's livelihood. We recognize that there is a need for a vibrant and prosperous commercial fishery. And I think it's important to also point out that the work that's been done by the Colvilles, as Mr. Smith described, clearly demonstrates that there are other alternatives that are viable when it comes to harvesting these fish and doing that in a way with a very low mortality, and in the one example to where there was no mortality to those wild fish. So again, 2579 opens the door and provides the opportunity to develop those selective fisheries. Just in closing, real quick, I don't want to overrun here, some numbers for you to consider. Mr. Melcher did a great job of outlining the current situation of the fisheries on the Columbia River. But I'd like to point out that in the 1800s, there were over 16 million salmon returning annually to the Columbia River. Last year, there was less than 1 million salmon returning to the Columbia River. And that included a bonus of about 250,000 sockeye that nobody expected to show up. That's a staggering 94% reduction in the number of fish that are currently coming back to the Columbia River. Over half of our region's historic salmon and steelhead runs are already extinct. More than half of the 28 species of salmon and steelhead currently listed under the ESA are found in Oregon waters, and a significant number of those are lower Columbia River stocks. Over $1 billion is spent annually to recover these fish. Money that's being paid by ratepayers, by all of us. We're all contributing to the recovery of these fish. And we are not seeing a significant payback on that investment. CCA agrees with the HSRG that decision makers need to pay attention and adapt to the latest science. And we need to do it before it's too late. Our fisheries need to be managed in accordance with that science and the facts that tell us what is best for our fish. The science clearly supports selective harvest. And in developing methods of selective harvest, everybody benefits. Oregon benefits, the Northwest benefits, the Northwest benefits, the commercial interests gain, the recreational interests gain, and most importantly, at the center of it all, our fish gain. It's a true win-win. And House Bill 2579 is a critical first step in implementing selective commercial fishing gear, and CCA strongly encourages your support. Bruce and Steve and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, and we can do that in a minute and 15 seconds if there is any question for this panel. Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask you, and I'll ask folks on the other side of the issue from you to speak to the claims of gill nets and tangle nets and seines about the mortality rates. And there's a lot of people walking around the Capitol saying that gill nets cause 40% release mortality, tangle nets cause 20%. And there are a lot of other people walking around the Capitol saying, no, you know, gill nets don't cause more than 12% or 14% or something. And so there's a big discrepancy in claims, and I'm wondering what it's based on. So I don't know.
I think there's literature, Representative Reed, and I don't see a name.
Representative Edwards.
Edwards. Chair Reed, Representative Edwards, thank you. I think there's quite a bit of conflicting data that you can find in fisheries documentation that anyone can grab to show mortality rates from different gears and different fisheries, but a lot of it's not peer-reviewed. It hasn't been really vetted and checked out, so I think different constituency groups can grab a hold of the number they want to use. The numbers that are currently used are not too far what you just first mentioned, 40% for large mesh gear on salmon in the Columbia River in the spring Chinook fishery. A lot of the fishery, the majority of the fish that are harvested in the Columbia River in the gillnet fisheries are in non-selective fisheries altogether, where they keep every fish that hits the net, because when those waters are warmer in the Columbia River in the fall Chinook and coho seasons, the fish can't be revived in that 60 to 70 degree water. So really for us, the answer is simple. That's why we went to the effort to bring Steve here and ask for his scientific opinion on this. All over the world, people have found ways to harvest fish for commercial sale without the use of a gill net. And we think it's time that if the Northwest is serious about recovery of our fish stocks, we start finding some new gear so that if we're going to commercially harvest fish, it's done without the use of a gill net. I hope that answered your question.
Thank you. And Representative Witt, if you could be really quick, we'll keep it going. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would our purposes and needs would be well served if we asked those kinds of technical questions from the department.
Thank you. We'll move on to the next panel. It is a group from Safer Salmon, Jim Martin, Joyce Sherman, and B.G. Eilertson. I hope I've pronounced that acceptably. Thank you. And as before, I'll start the clock when you're seated and ready to go.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, committee members. I'm Jim Martin. I'm a retired chief of fisheries for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and a former salmon advisor to Governor John Kitzhaber. I'm the lead author of the Safe for Salmon report, and we have three other of our authors who are all retired fish and wildlife biologists of long repute. Don Schwartz, Rod Sando, and Bill Shea. Between us, we have about 150 years of experience managing lower Columbia fisheries and similar fisheries. Our Safe for Salmon concept is characterized in House Bill 2734. It would redesign hatchery releases and harvest management in the lower Columbia River to increase economic benefits to both recreational and commercial fisheries, reduce mixed stock harvest rates of wild fish of most species, reduce hatchery strays in the spawning ground that we just heard about, and very importantly, end the damaging conflict that's been going on for far too long between sport and commercial fishermen. The basic idea is to build from the successful and non-controversial safe fisheries that have been going on for nearly 20 years, where hatchery fish are released in the bays and sloughs of the lower Columbia, specifically turning off when they return as adults for the commercial gillnet fishery. These programs currently produce well over half of the total commercial catch of spring chinook, up to 70% on some years. They also produce roughly 30% of the fall salmon commercial catch. We can increase the releases in the bays and sloughs to fully compensate commercial fishermen for ending main stem gillnet in wild and hatchery salmon, sturgeon, smelt, and shad. This will allow expansion of sport fishing for better economic utilization, more stable and dependable sport fishing seasons for our tourist economy, and end this conflict. We have the knowledge, the experience, and the hatchery capacity in this basin to do this. Both Washington and Oregon Departments of Fish and Wildlife are already committed to substantial reprogramming from tributary hatcheries to safe areas now. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, for example, is committed to moving millions of smolts from tributary hatcheries to safe areas to reduce strain on the wild spawning grounds in direct response to the HSRG recommendations you just heard about. ODFW is proposing to move between 250,000 and 1,000,000 spring chinook smolts to safe areas as well. That's in contrast to 850,000 they're currently releasing. So if they release 1,000,000, it's substantially more than doubling. Obviously, both departments see increasing safe production as economically and logistically doable and the resulting fisheries as manageable. However, we believe that such increases justify eliminating main stem gillnetting for economic and conservation reasons. We can increase Oregon's tourist economy by enhancing dependable sport fishing seasons while maintaining commercial markets and jobs. We will also increase the number of salmon in the Oregon offshore area by releasing them closer to the ocean for better survival. This divisive controversy that's been going on intensively for 50 years, Walt McGovern's in this room and has watched and fought this battle for nearly 50 years. 50 years we've been fighting it out. It's not getting any better as Oregon grows and the ESA limits tighten. We need a win-win solution that improves value for all Oregonians and ends this conflict.
Honorable Chair Reed, committee members, my name is B.G. Eilertson, and I'm a merchandise manager for Joe Sports in Wilsonville, Oregon, and I'm a resident of Sherwood. I've been with Joe's for the past 38 years, and I've seen all kinds of economic cycles. As you're aware, Joe's recently filed Chapter 11, and we're working hard to avoid closing. Columbia River salmon season have a sizable negative financial impact on our company these last few years. Joe's has 30 stores, employs over 1,600 people, over which 1,000 work in Oregon. Joe's is a snapshot of the regional sport fishing industry. With some 600,000 fishing licenses sold in Oregon, we see firsthand how fisheries fuel our business. Columbia River salmon are a driving force in our stores and the dozens of vendors, large and small, we support. Many of these vendors are located in Oregon and are impacted by downturns in our sales. Beyond Joe's are the hundreds of Oregon-based businesses that share our fate. The Oregon sport fishing industry provides jobs to 11,000 Oregonians and generates $331 million in revenue or salaries and $71 million in state and local taxes. More recent numbers point to a multi-billion dollar a year industry when boat sales are included. To Oregon's economy, spring Chinook are worth their weight in gold. Economic studies show how direct expenditures of about $65 a day, an amount so valuable to the local economies, most states have shifted priorities from sport to commercial to sport. When we stop to realize that it takes on average 8 days of fishing expenditures to get one hatchery spring Chinook to take home, you see a fish worth over $500. The Safer Salmon Coalition is currently working with economists to hindcast the full economic benefits of safer salmon since 2001. A preliminary look back tells us that for just spring Chinook, our region would have enjoyed over 1.65 million angler trips and a minimum of an additional $39 million in expenditures. This figure does not include spending for fishing equipment and other durable goods, which is exactly what our stores sell. The same analysis will be done shortly for summer Chinook, fall Chinook, and coho transfers. I've attached a more detailed explanation of what happens when ESA mortalities are transferred from gillnet fisheries to the sport fisheries. Imagine the economic impacts of a sport salmon season open for 8 months out of the year instead of the scattered few weeks that we have now. This economic faucet is shut off when Columbia River sport fishing salmon seasons are closed, eliminating sales of durable goods and stopping guide trips and angler days in their tracks. Last year, our business started with a spring Chinook season that shut down April 21st. We had widespread coastal salmon closures, an 8-day season for summer Chinook, a buoy 10 fishery that was closed over Labor Day weekend, and a shortened fall Chinook season. In the last 8 months, Stevens Marine had to reduce its workforce from 58 to 23 people, with a corresponding revenue drop of $10 million. Their decline started with the closure of spring Chinook season on the Columbia River and continues today. Columbia River-bound salmon are their lifeblood, and these short and uncertain seasons are choking their 38-year-old business. Stevens Marine grew 12% in 2001 and another 10% in 2002. Keep those years in mind. North River Boats of Roseburg just closed all of its retail locations, leaving dozens of Oregonians out of work. Some would blame the economy, but with 3 decades of history to fall back on, I see a very different picture. In 2001 and 2002, Oregon posted the highest unemployment rates in the country. But having fuller spring Chinook seasons, our businesses grew at a double-digit pace. Tackle and boat sales soared in response to those seasons as the sport fishing industry was touted as recession-proof in papers across the landscape. Clearly, this last couple of years has been a disaster for our industry. The issue is failed state processes and policies that have resulted in thousands of layoffs with hundreds more imminent. We have exhausted every available avenue to resolve these problems outside of this building. All have failed us. Seasons are set a month or two ahead of the actual dates and then abruptly closed in mid-season. How do you plan inventory, create anticipation for the season, and take full value of them? How do we attract out-of-state visitors and stimulate tourism when the processes and policies governing these seasons are in such turmoil? This year, with the third largest spring Chinook return projected since 1938, we had hoped to settle seasons in December. Washington's Fish and Wildlife Commission wanted to expand the recreational season, while Oregon's commission voted further to ratchet it down. The states couldn't reach agreement until mid-February after multiple meetings and reams of negative press. It's been a disaster, and it's getting worse. The states still haven't reached any agreement for the May spring Chinook fishing season on the Columbia. We've been told by the ODFW Commission and staff that this reflects the will of the legislature. I find that hard to believe. We must have a win-win solution, not the status quo. How many more businesses need to go away and jobs be lost before we realize that the situation demands immediate attention. We are in crisis mode right now.
I'll just point out we're passing 10 minutes here for you as well. Thank you.
Thank you. What's safe for salmon will deliver to Oregon is stable fisheries we can grow. The ODFW will tell you how many salmon tags they sold when salmon runs are full. It's a lot more than they're selling today. The easiest and surest way to fund ODFW is to get these seasons back on track. Safe for salmon will expand seasons that we can leverage to the benefit of the Columbia Basin communities from Astoria to Hermiston. Sport fishing and commercial businesses across the state stand to benefit. Safe for salmon provides benefits beyond the Columbia as coho stocks that are used in these fisheries migrate south off our coast and provide important coastal, commercial, and recreational fisheries. Safe for salmon will drive tourism. It's hard to book a trip in Oregon to fish for salmon when there's so much uncertainty due to shared impacts and emergency closures. Hundreds are crossing Oregon off their list of places to fish because of these failed processes and policies. I'd like to emphasize Safe for Salmon ends the unproductive, acrimonious conflict that has made this issue so toxic for so long. And it creates a win-win scenario for commercial and recreational fishing businesses. I didn't come here today to bash gill netters or gill netting. I came here looking for help and answers that might save my business and keep the commercial community whole. All of us need help, and the processes and policies we have are failing us and costing the state tens of millions of dollars. I believe Safe for Salmon provides the answers that benefit us all. I ask for your guidance and support. Thank you for allowing my testimony, and thank you for the service to the state.
Thank you very much. Ms. Sherman, you have 8 minutes left.
Chair Reed, committee members, I'm Joyce Sherman, a fish advocate for over 30 years, Northwest Steelheaders Communications Director, Native Fish Society River Steward, and co-owner of River Graphics, which gives back to fish by donating design and printing to organizations that protect and restore wild salmon and steelhead. Never before have we had an opportunity to provide better conditions for wild salmon, steelhead, and sturgeon, more stable and expanded seasons for sport anglers, and access to prime fish for commercial gill netters in one new management program. House Bill 2734, Safe for Salmon, is a win for everyone. Safe for Salmon will reduce the commercial bycatch of wild steelhead, sockeye, summer chinook, fall chinook, and coho. Only spring chinook fisheries in the non-Indian lower Columbia fishery will have the same harvest rate, roughly 2% impact on the wild run by non-treaty fishermen. ODFW is currently analyzing how much the harvest rates for most species will be lowered under Safe for Salmon compared to the status quo. Safe for Salmon will harvest more hatchery fish with less impact on most stocks of ESA-listed wild fish, a conservation plus for everyone. Safe for Salmon will reduce lower river hatchery strays on the spawning grounds, mixing with listed wild fish. History has shown that fish returning to safe areas are harvested at 95% or higher, reducing strays. Currently, stray hatchery fish flood many lower Columbia River spawning streams, wasting economic value and causing genetic damage to ESA-listed wild fish. The Hatchery Reform Project has shown this, and Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is currently planning to move millions of smolts to safe areas to reduce impacts on spawning populations in Washington tributaries. This will be a huge economic benefit to the gill netters of the lower Columbia. It will reduce sport fishing in key Washington tributaries, but sportsmen are willing to shoulder the burden to reduce stress on listed wild fish. Coho, once reared and released on Oregon's central coast, are already being reared in Young's Bay net pens for the commercial fleet. While these fish are in the ocean, they will be available to sport, charter, and commercial fishermen on the Oregon coast. With passage of House Bill 2734, the current day-by-day list of when and where fishing will be allowed will end. Both gill netters and sport anglers will have dependable, stable seasons decided well in advance. It is my belief that ODFW will experience an increase in sport fishing license sales. Another benefit to ODFW will be lower management costs. The current on-off days per week early closure seasons are killing our conservation funding base and our tourist economy. Sport license sales are a key component supporting the conservation mission of ODFW. Commercial fees support less than 1% of ODFW's budget. Increased sport license sales will enable ODFW to effectively continue its conservation mission. While I would love to see the end of the annual pitched battle over spring Chinook allocation between sport and commercial anglers, for me, the most compelling feature of the Safe for Salmon plan is that wild steelhead, threatened Snake River sockeye, sturgeon, and other bycatch will no longer be sacrificed in the gillnet fishing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This proposal is not perfect, and it will not solve all the problems of fisheries economics or management in the Lower Columbia, but it's dramatically better than the status quo. It's fair to commercial fishermen and will continue the availability of fish for the market. It will increase economic benefits to Oregon at a time we desperately need economic assistance. It will have a lighter touch on the wild fish, fewer hatchery strays, and a better funding base for the conservation mission of ODFW. To our friends in the tribes, we recommit ourselves, as we did in our presentation to them, to respect the U.S.-Oregon management plan. We want to reassure them that tribal fishermen will be better off under Safer Salmon than under the status quo. We encourage the Technical Advisory Committee to the federal court to analyze projected tribal catch under Safer Salmon policies versus the status quo. The tribes would catch more steelhead, sockeye, fall chinook, coho, and more total catch under Safer Salmon than status quo. To our friends in the gillnet industry, we point out that safe areas have been very successfully providing over half of some species of their catch and roughly one-third of total income for the industry. These areas can handle more fish and more fishing without excessive gear conflict. We will commit to working out any gear conflict situations that may make fishing unmanageable. These safe fisheries have been successful for many years and will be in the future. Both departments obviously believe this, or they wouldn't be tripling production there. To the Departments of Fish and Wildlife, we look forward to working out the logistical and financial details of implementing this policy over the next few years. We think that their moves are in the right direction and justify complete elimination of mainstem gill netting. Safer Salmon fuels important economies that support dozens of Oregon communities, industries around the state, Oregon tourism, and coastal commercial charter and recreational interests, as well as ODFW funding base. Most of all, we think the social conflict will continue to get worse unless a new design is developed to modernize these outdated fishing patterns. Our economy is in crisis. Safer Salmon provides a major increase for our tourist economy. Current safe fisheries show us how to have a win-win without this poisonous conflict that is so damaging amongst the Columbia River fish community. A win-win is not only possible, but it is crucial at this point in Oregon's history. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. You've left us about a minute and a half if there are any questions. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to know what percentage of Joe's sales is attributable to fishing gear net of license sales.
Actually, I can provide that information for you and anyone else in the committee that would like it. I'd rather it not be on public record at this point. However, I can tell you that in a critical time period, which is between holiday sales and the summer when all recreational activity begins, our fishing department is our third largest department within our organization. And frankly, when we take a hit to that, we take a hit to the entire company. If you take a look at a graph that I shared with you, we had a 40% swing or 37% swing in the in our sales from when they closed the Columbia River sport fishing season last April 21st. That was from a 19% or 18% positive to a 19% negative. Nobody can afford that in this kind of economy. So hopefully that answers your question. If you want more details, I can provide them.
It would be helpful, given your testimony that suggests that a loss of sales due to declining fish populations is what has driven profit and employee declines. Being the third largest department in your store, it would certainly be helpful for me to be able to understand that impact.
Right.
It appears that there are other drivers involved here as well.
Well, yes, very much so.
Thank you very much. We have time for our next panel. Salmon for All is next. Bruce Buckmaster, Jim Wells, and Peter Roscoe, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Buckmaster. I'm legislative chair of Salmon for All. I'd like to introduce our president, a commercial fisherman, Jim Wells, and Peter Roscoe, city councilman from Astoria, a restaurant owner and member of the board of the Oregon Restaurant Association. And we'd like to begin with Mr. Wells. Thank you.
Chair Reed and representatives. My name is Jim Wells from Astoria, Salmon for All president. I'm also a member of the Columbia River Commercial Fishery Advisory Committee. Help advise the states in setting seasons. My experience, 40 plus years of commercial fishing, Alaska, Oregon, Washington, California. I've gill netted, long line for halibut, black cod, pot fish for crab, trolled for salmon and tuna, and I have purse seine for salmon. Once again, well over 40 years experience. Salmon for All is a nonprofit trade association of Columbia River commercial fishermen and processors. We represent roughly 500 permit holders in both Oregon and Washington. We have many issues of concern with House Bill 2781, the total net ban on the Columbia River, House Bill 2579, legalizing fixed gear, and House Bill 2734, the Safe for Salmon Bill. I will briefly comment on the first two bills mentioned and go into more detail why the Safe for Salmon bill does not create the sponsor's win-win fisheries it promises. House Bill 2781, the total net ban. As written, it would ban Native American fisheries. It would ban wholesale buyers from purchasing any net-caught salmon, steelhead, or sturgeon, and that would include tribal fish. Bans ever-developing alternative gear types, such as seines, traps, or fish wheels, because these all involve netting materials. House Bill 2781 offers no compensation for losses to fishermen, processors, or support industries, such as marine supply and retail stores. This bill would eliminate the TangleNet LifeBox alternative fishing gear we have developed and proven to be very successful in ESA fisheries. House Bill 2781 potentially violates the recently signed 10-year U.S. v. Oregon agreement involving the Treaty Indian Fisheries. Salmon for All urges a no vote on House Bill 2781. House Bill 2579, legalized fixed gear in the Columbia River. That would be traps, fish wheels, and seines. That was introduced by Representative Gilliam. This bill directly contradicts Representative Gilliam's House Bill 2781, the total net ban, because it legalizes the above-mentioned fixed gear that all involve netting materials. Our contention is that our current gear, the gill nets, used in our commercial fishery, are highly selective when being deployed when target stocks are abundant and listed stocks are not. This is determined by test fishing before full fleet openings. When managed by time, area, and mesh size restrictions, the gill net is one of the most efficient and conservation-oriented gears in commercial fishing worldwide today. On the traps and seines, they were used many years ago in the Columbia River and were outlawed via initiative petition. In the past, the trap owners hired men to eliminate marine mammals, the seals, that congregated near the traps to feed. With the current sea lion predation problem we all know exists now in the Columbia River, traps would become a feeding station much like fish ladders are at Bonneville Dam. In the present political climate, It would be a real stretch to imagine PETA and the Humane Society allowing individual fishermen and trap operators to defend their fixed gear from hungry, grossly overpopulated marine mammals. Seines are a very effective way to harvest large volumes of salmon when used in the right conditions. Seine boats normally require a 3 to 4 man crew to operate, including a skiff man. The current gillnet boat can be operated in a lower volume fishery with one man and sometimes one crewman at most. In most situations, it would not be economically viable for 3 to 4 families to expect to make money off one boat, as the volume of catch needed to sustain the larger operations would rarely be available on the main stem. When trying to move to alternative gear types to be more selective in harvest, good science dictates doing extensive research first, then using the data gathered to move forward or eliminate the proposal if necessary. For trap seines or fish wheels, the released unmarked fish would have to be pit tagged and traced to their natal streams or rivers to establish a mortality release rate. Sport, treaty, and non-treaty commercial fisheries and loss due to dams would have to be factored in. All of this was done when we developed our tangle net fishery, but we doubt the money exists now to undertake this very expensive procedure in today's endangered species arena. Salmon for All's position is to not try to deter sound science from moving forward to make fisheries better and more productive for everybody. These bills do not accomplish this. Under ORS 506-450-465, it is possible to obtain a permit for testing and researching alternative gears without passing a law to legalize them before the scientific research has been done to prove their worth. For the reasons stated above and many more, Salmon for All urges a no vote on House Bill 2579 and House Bill 2781. They set bad policy. I have a Safe for Salmon information flyer here. I'll make two comments. 1.5 prioritizes the Columbia River for sport fishing under their bill. That's true. 0.6 actually increases commercial salmon catches. That's false. House Bill 2734, Safe for Salmon Bill. The author is former Oregon Department Fish and Wildlife employee Jim Martin, and pushed by NSIA, the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, Puget Sound Anglers, and various guided sport fishing groups. This bill is opposed by Salmon for All. You'll hear the treaty tribes weigh in on it later. Native Fish Society, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the Oregon Restaurant Association, and West Coast Processors Association. Proponents say the Columbia River is in chaos. This is not the truth. With predicted runs of 300 to 350,000 upriver spring salmon, 183,000 sockeye, 70,000 summer fish, and 1 million plus coho, and a very healthy Hanford Reach wild Chinook fall run, there is more than enough surplus fish for all users. Just a few years back, nobody was fishing for spring salmon, sockeye, or summer Chinook. The sport industry already catches 80% of the non-treaty spring salmon in the Columbia Basin. They take 80% of the sturgeon below Bonneville. They have 100% of the non-treaty steelhead to catch, and that run will be 300 to 350,000 upriver steelhead this year, a big run. Large majority of the summer salmon. This fall on the fall coho run of a million fish, 296,000 go to the ocean sport, 112 go to buoy 10, 112,000. That's a total of 308,000 coho to the sport industry. The main stem gillnet fleet is penciled in for 38,000 fish harvest. They control a huge majority of the coho now, too. Regardless of what the proponents say, there is no conservation basis associated with this bill. It is simply an allocation grab to take the last of the fish from the commercial fisherman and the taxpaying consumer. The treaty tribes, I'm speculating, the treaty tribes will object to this bill because it will violate the 50-50 sharing agreement that was court ordered in the early 70s. It will also lead to violating the new 10-year USV Oregon agreement by eliminating a commercial fishery from the main stem. The geographic area of the current select areas are not large enough to accommodate the whole gillnet fleet. Expansion into other areas are not feasible without additional ESA impacts being allocated to the commercial fleet, and I'm sure that's not going to happen. The forced move to select areas only will result in the loss of approximately $5 million in nets designed for the deeper main stem areas. There is no compensation provision included. Funding to maintain select areas we fish now is fragile at best. The BPA, our major source of funding, is looking for any excuse to terminate the project as a cost-saving measure. Expansion funds would have to come from the states, and we're suspecting that that's not presently feasible. The Safe for Salmon plan promises approximately 12,000 spring salmon annually for selects on a steady basis. In 2008, we caught 3,400, and the 2009 prediction is about the same. In 2002 and 2004, with selects and main stem fisheries combined, we harvested 26,000 and almost 28,000, respectively. Why would we give that up for a lofty, underfunded, hollow promise? House Bill 2734 promises that if the commercial fleet were removed from the main stem, more hatchery fish could be eliminated from the spawning beds of wild fish. Once again, that's not true. NOAA Fisheries is on record saying this is not possible without the use of the gillnet fleet. Sport fishing alone can't eliminate much of the large hatchery surplus runs before they co-mingle with the wild stocks. Mr. Martin and his co-sponsors promised double the fish return if smolts are released from select areas versus main stem hatcheries. Once again, not a factual statement. Oregon State statistics show smolt to adult survival rates only very slightly improved on spring salmon, and on coho, no difference whether released from select areas or from main stem hatcheries. Increasing the return twofold with no smolt increases is not possible. Finally, on the economic side, the cost to our fleet and lower river communities will be devastating. The recent ex-vessel value of select area fisheries has been roughly $1 million per year. If limited to only select areas, the volume of our main stem catches would have to be made up to make us whole, as promised. We would lose our main stem spring Chinook, summer Chinook, fall Chinook, coho, and 7,000 sturgeon. When applying the last three-year average weight and ex-vessel price per pound, the combined total ex-vessel value on our share of the 2009 forecast run is in excess of $3.6 million. When the standard economic multiplier of 3.5 is applied, that's a $12.7 million loss to our presently economically devastated lower river communities. As a lifetime fisherman, I am advising you there is no way enough smolts can be pumped out of select areas to return enough fish to make up for that kind of loss. This bill is nothing but a thinly disguised allocation grab from commercial fisheries and the taxpaying consumer. Salmon Fall urges a no vote on House Bill 2734.
Chair Reed and the committee, my name is Peter Roscoe. Bruce said, I am a city councilor of the city of Astoria. I'm a restaurant owner, chef and owner of a little restaurant in Astoria. I'm a member of the Oregon Restaurant Association Board of Directors, and I'm also on the Oregon and Washington Departments of Fish and Wildlife Advisory Committee on the all fisheries on the main stem of the Columbia River. And I don't have a lot of statistics. I kind of come into this as the end user that represents the taxpaying non-fishing public. But I can tell you that as a restaurateur who's fully engaged in local and sustainable products, and as a member of the Oregon Restaurant Association, I have been an advocate for maintaining, Our commercial fishermen are the ones that represent our restaurants and our markets. And at the Oregon Restaurant Association level, we are fully engaged with the Oregon Lodging Association, the Oregon Tourism Board, in making Oregon a culinary destination. When people come here, one of the first things they want is they want Columbia River Spring Chinook. It's what everybody wants. When our visitor comes from New York and they come here, that's what they want. So if we take this safe bill, this is what we're going to have in our Higgins restaurant, in our Wildwood restaurant, in our Heathman restaurant, in Marche restaurant, in Fulio's restaurant, whatever restaurant is in your community, they're throughout the state that are engaged in this type of restaurant. Welcome to my restaurant. This is our fish of the day tonight is an Atlantic farm-raised fish, or we do have a net pen fish that's been caught in a slough, but we don't have the main stem wild fish. We're not allowed to catch and sell that. As restaurateurs, as a non-fishing, although I enjoy sport fishing, I don't have anything against sport fishing. I love sport fishing. I go sport fishing, and I welcome sport fishermen to my community and to my restaurant all the time. But I depend on the commercial fishermen to supply me with the fish that my customers demand. And they want to know. They ask that question, where did this fish come from? Is this a farm-raised fish? They want to know. They are very discerning. And, you know, this state is spending a lot of money right now on ads in magazines like Savure, Food and Wine, Sunset Magazine. They show pictures of chefs from our state, and they are advocating that we are, and we've done a great job of becoming this culinary hotspot. But without that product, what are we going to sell? And, you know, I can tell you that an erosion of fishing, commercial fishing, is also an attack on the history of Astoria. The overriding image of Astoria is not that of a sport fisherman, it's that of a commercial fisherman that has helped to feed the world. And, you know, we don't want an erosion of that history. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. We have 3 minutes remaining if you want to use it.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Buckmaster, and I live in Astoria, Oregon. I'm a former business owner of a manufacturing company, a card-carrying member of the Fly Fishing Club of Oregon, and legislative chair of Salmon for All. I also believe I'm the only testifier today who served on all three of the collaborative groups mentioned by the department. It's painfully ironic that I find myself here in this recession discussing bills which will absolutely cause job loss in my community. And let me be clear, all three of these bills that are before this committee, what they have in common is the certainty that hardworking Oregon independent small businesses will lose their jobs. One bill, which I appreciate, is just an outright ban in its simplicity. I abhor its intent. One is unnecessary, the gear bill, because we have actually asked for a policy option package, found the funding for it through the Commercial Fish Fund, found funding a grant in the state of Washington to seek better gear. In the same way, we have proven that we are willing to do that through our development and implementation of the Tangled Net. Mr. Wells has explained our opposition to the individual bills. Mr. Roscoe has clearly articulated the importance of our product. And we've spoken in numerous forums for numerous years about our willingness to share the resource. I think we have shown most of you individually, and it's in the packet that I believe was passed out erroneously for the Safer Salmon testimony, the ODFW, WDFW statistics that show that the sport fishing industry currently and has since the beginning of this main stem fishery enjoyed over 80% of the harvest of the Columbia River spring hatchery Chinook. We've also shown who funds those hatcheries. We readily stipulate that the license fees of the sport fishing industry is very important to the department. And sport fishermen are very important to Oregon. But these hatchery fish, the cost of producing them is borne 1.2% by license fees, 3.5% by federal sport fishing fees, 24% by Mitchell Act fees, or Mitchell Act funds, which are being apportioned for the damage caused to the Columbia River fishing communities, commercial fishing communities, and the tribes for loss due to hydro.
And Mr. Buckmaster, we're just passing 20 minutes, so I'll give you 30 seconds. How about that?
That is fine. Commercial fishing industry, along with tribes, environmentalists, and sportsmen, will always champion the cause of fish. But commercial fishermen and their communities provide a unique service. Through their efforts, we continually recruit non-fishing citizens to join the Salmon Nation. We provide access to the very best bounty of the Columbia River. Fresh Columbia River salmon and sturgeon are featured in our signature restaurants, esteem fish markets, and we recruit and allow the fish to recruit the continued support the resource must have. Our fishermen, their communities, and the fish themselves need the unique link to the general public that only commercial fishing can provide. Each of the proposed bills will sever that link to the detriment of Oregonians, Oregon, and its unique heritage. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for a quick summation. That concludes the panels that have a specific interest, I think, based on different perspectives. And I want to give a chance to testify to the legislators who have been involved. Representative Boone, your timing was perfect. You walked in just before. Okay. Well, let's start with Senator Girard, who has been very patient, and I know Representative Brune was interested in testifying as well. As you're getting settled, it's as many of you know, accustomed to allow legislators to go first, but in this case, I appreciate the patience of legislators so that we've had a chance to kind of hear some of the background before we can get the right perspective. So, Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Chair Reed, colleagues, I want to thank you for hearing this important issue. For the record, I'm Senator Fred Girard. I represent the rural parts of Clackamas, Marion, and Linn counties. More importantly, I represent the North Saniam, South Saniam, Upper Clackamas, and Mullala watersheds. I come before you today with what I consider to be the most important issue this session. We have a major problem with salmon. As most of you know, I'm an avid fisherman. Caught my first steelhead when I was 5 years old, my first salmon when I was 7. The Willamette River and other Columbia River tributaries have seen the salmon runs decimated. As of Sunday, only 6 spring salmon have gone over Willamette Falls. 6. We have little choice but to end gill netting, which indiscriminately kills fish and does not allow for selective harvest. Now, one point I want to bring up and bring you up to speed on, most of you probably know there are really two major types of fish that in the river. There's several different kinds of salmon, but there's two that we look at, Chinook and King, Silver and Coho. Sockeye are kind of they're a minor entity. The Chinook run has 3 separate runs. That was brought out. There's the spring, the summer, and the fall runs. The Willamette, for example, is affected mainly by the spring run. Rivers like the Clackamas, the North Saniam, the South Saniam have a separate species designation as to where they are located. So each river has a separate run. Only migratory fish like steelhead and sturgeon, they also have separate designations. The steelhead is by winter and summer runs, so there's 2 different types of steelhead. Another thing I want to make clear that was kind of a little foggy in the testimony, it isn't the number of fish that you catch. It's the number of ESA-listed fish that you kill. So the reason commercial fishing doesn't get as big a catch as sports fishing, they kill their fish faster. And that's what we're saying. So I'd like to talk about House Bill 2781 and why I want to eliminate gill net. Now, I have two major reasons for ending gill net. The first one is simple numbers. There were 48 gill netters that caught fish last year. 48. There were hundreds of thousands of sports fishermen, and it is a multi-billion dollar industry that is often recession-proof. In my Senate district alone, I have over 33,000 sportsmen. Think about the cottage industries, boat and motor manufacturers, tackle shops, fishing pole manufacturers, bait manufacturers, motels, restaurants, boat rentals, marinas, and guides, to mention a few. Because of the terrible salmon runs, these industries are losing billions of dollars and the state is losing millions. To add insult to injury, the gill netter pays a whopping $74 for a license and made on average $6,000 from Columbia River fish. Hundreds of thousands of sportsmen pay nearly $50, and yet Oregon Fish and Wildlife want to allow gill netters 50% of the ESA fish kill. This is nuts. Colleagues, I fished for spring salmon, commonly known as springers, on the Willamette for roughly 10 years. The first 5 years, I averaged around 1.5 salmon per day. 2 years ago, I went 8 times and never got a hookup. I used the same guide, the same time of year, with the same methods. We have a serious problem in the Willamette with salmon. The second reason I support an outright ban is something that hasn't been addressed, and that's the other multi-billion dollar industries that are in jeopardy. In my district, I have several threatened fish. In most cases, they are the spring salmon and the winter steelhead. What will happen if these fish go totally endangered? One only has to look at the Sacramento River and the Klamath River basins for the answer. For example, minimum stream flows could be enforced on the North Sandyam River or on the McKenzie. The cities of Salem and Staten, along with the Sandyam Water District, would have their water rights severely limited. It would be an economic disaster for food processors, farmers, microchip processors, or any industry that requires water. Going green in those communities would not be allowed as lawns, gardens, and landscapes could not be irrigated. Dam removal would not be out of the question. All my watersheds could be affected. As you can see, I have no choice but to ask a bill that would totally, once and for all, end gill netting in the Columbia River. Colleagues, there are several arguments against the ban on gill netting. Some say it's a step towards the total elimination of commercial salmon fishing. Nothing could be further from the truth. My bill does not eliminate commercial fishing on the Columbia. It eliminates the use of gill nets. Selective harvest methods can be used, such as barbless hook and line, or I would take an amendment to allow seine nets where wild fish could be released unharmed back to the river. Again, we need to look at the likelihood that the tributaries of the Willamette River and other Oregon rivers like the John Day, Deschutes, Sandy will go down the same path as the Sacramento and Klamath. What happens there? What happened there to commercial salmon fishing? The southern Oregon coast salmon fishing was shut down. What will happen to commercial salmon fishing along the Oregon coast if Willamette fish numbers do not improve? Commercial salmon fishing would be shut down. This is a way to save commercial fishing, not destroy it. Some say that the state of Washington might not follow suit. The state of Washington has not been the problem in salmon recovery. It is the state of Oregon. Washington has gone for smaller allotments of gill netters only to be opposed by Oregon. Both governor candidates from Washington ran on selective harvest platforms in the last elections. There has been talk that the bill that I proposed would eliminate fishing for Native Americans. Nothing could be further from the truth as far as the intent of that bill. I recognize Native rights, and I would encourage them to use selective harvest, but there would be absolutely no intention to impact Natives' rights to use whatever they want to take their allotment of the fish. Colleagues, you have heard testimony that about selective harvest or that gill netting is selective harvest. This is total bullpucky. Gill nets are aptly named. The salmon or steelhead swim upstream and their heads go through the net. Their gill plates do not allow them to back up. They get stuck, they drown. The Columbia River is the only river in the United States other than Alaska that allows this outdated barbaric practice. Colleagues, given the collapse of our salmon runs and the financial impacts on our sports fishing industry, and yet worse, the potential impact caused by the Endangered Species Act, I am reminded of a saying, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Colleagues, we have to eliminate gill netting on the Columbia River. We have no choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Girard. Representative Broome. And appreciate two other legislators behind you. So we'll
yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this hearing, and I think it's been an extraordinarily well-managed hearing. Apparently, when you moved to I'm Scott Bruin, House District 37. Apparently, when you moved to the Senate, you get to use terms like bullpucky, and I haven't had an opportunity to use that yet.
We can only aspire to that.
Well, aspire to that, something I can look forward to, hopefully. Chair and committee, my family has a long time history of, like I'm sure many of us do, of fishing in Oregon. My grandfather was a Norwegian immigrant who came here and avidly fished the Columbia while he was still alive. And one of his delicacies that he liked to put down on his family members was salmon head stew, if you could imagine. So imagine a boiling pot of water on the stove with all sorts of vegetables and whatnot, and heads floating in the stew. And that was something he loved until the date he died. I suggested to my wife during this last campaign cycle that we use that as a fundraiser, and she thought that may not be a good idea, so we decided not to do that. Also, speaking of family, I also have a long-standing tradition. I have a family member who has made his living fishing in Oregon through his entire adult life. So I have a background in that. But you don't need to have a background in fishing in Oregon, whether it's commercial or sports or however you look at it, to understand when you're looking at the Columbia River that it is the environmental and ecological bloodline of the state. It is a powerful, mighty resource, and a hardy one, but it is not an infallible one, and it is not one that doesn't require careful management and attention. As has been well described already, the demands on the river have increased with time and with population growth. And just to hit on a few of the things that we demand of our river, we demand water. We demand power, we demand transportation, we demand commerce, we demand recreation, and even in this new world we live in, we demand things like carbon mitigation. So the demands on the river have dramatically increased over recent decades. My advocacy for House Bill 2734, which is the Safe for Salmon legislation, basically came to me in an informal and perhaps the most direct way that most of us who serve do see this. It was through constituents, and it was through constituents in my district, fishermen and women, that would email me, and you know they're authentic because it's those emails we get that aren't boilerplate, the phone calls and letters that we get that aren't boilerplate. They're all organic, they're all original. But the message was generally the same, which was, what's going on? Help us. Please help us. And their complaint is that every year they're paying more and more in tag fees. Every year they're doing what they've been asked to do, which is to support the sustainable fisheries operation in the Columbia that we have and that they want and is their primary source of recreation for a lot of them. And yet every year we continue to go down we continue to contract their ability to go fishing. So they're paying more and they're fishing less. And it's, as one of them said to me, and I thought it was a great point, it's really not about the fish in the boat, Scott. It's about days on the river. And those of us who fish just want to fish. And that's what we're seeing. That's what, over the years, that's what's happening. What is going on is we have a 21st century demand system. We have a 21st century need, a 21st century obstacle to try to address, and yet we're still using the same management technologies and methods that we've been using for the last 40 or 50 years. I remember during the Clinton campaign, and I didn't like it at the time, but it made a lot of sense. If you keep doing the same thing, the definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing but expecting different results, and that's where we are in Columbia River fisheries management right now. My advocacy for this is of course, I advocate for sport fishing. I advocate for commercial fishing. I don't get my fish out of the Columbia from a boat. I get it from Safeway, and that obviously comes from Columbia fishermen or from commercial fishermen. But my fear is that if we do absolutely nothing, if we just keep going with the status quo without legislative intervention, we all lose. We lose the sports fishing. We lose the commercial fishing. We get to a point where the river, frankly, cannot keep up with the increased demand that we've put on over the years, and we end up looking on the Columbia River like we look in every other continental state in the country right now. The Columbia River is the only place, as far as I know, where this sort of where these sort of practices are still done. They're not done anywhere else except for Alaska. We don't want that to happen. I don't want to see a complete elimination of gill netting. It doesn't serve anybody's interest. So, once again, that was a little bit rambling, but that's, Mr. Chair, how I get to this point on 2734 and ask for your due consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I recognize Senator Johnson and Representative Boone are here as well. I'd like to hear from them. Thank you for your patience and for being here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, which runs along the Columbia River.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah Boone, for the record, House District 32, which is the upper left coast, Clatsop, Tillamook, a little bit of Columbia County, and a little bit of western Washington County.
Mr. Chair, we are here to read into the record a letter that was affirmed this morning between 7 and 8 o'clock with the 9 members of the Coastal Caucus. It is a February 12, 2009 letter addressed to the president, to leadership, basically. I won't go through all of them, as well as the requisite committees. Dear leadership, the Coastal Caucus is comprised of 9 coastal legislators, Republican and Democrat, both House and Senate, who represent the full length of the Oregon coast, the Columbia River, and the inland Klamath River system. We meet regularly to discuss pertinent issues affecting the coast. We operate on a consensus model, and while we don't always agree, we have created a forum for discussion that others have emulated. Today, we had the opportunity to hear informational briefings addressing commercial and recreational fishing on the Columbia River. We heard from representatives of Salmon for All, Save for Salmon, the Coastal Conservation Association, and other stakeholders. It is apparent that all the proposals lacked collaboration between the stakeholders. Finding a solution that meets the needs of both the commercial and the sport fishermen within the tight constraints of the Endangered Species Act and variable fishing stocks cannot be accomplished successfully through piecemeal legislative action. In order to develop effective policy, we strongly believe that it is critical to bring all of the relevant stakeholders into the discussion. As such, we respectfully request that any bills pertaining to commercial or recreational fishing gear or equipment or practices on the Columbia River be deferred until February 2010, and that you form an interim task force of stakeholders so that all the parties can participate in policy development, and it is signed by all 9 of the Coastal Caucus. The letter is being distributed to you. We wanted to make that part of the record, given that we are the people that represent these waters that you're discussing. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much, Senator. Representative.
Thank you. I'm not going to say any more. I've signed on to the letter, and I hope you read it, and that I am a full supporter of this premise. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It's an excellent brief summary of what I'm sure were longer discussions.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Next on our list, perspective from the tribes, only Pat Jr. and Kat Brigham. We appreciate your patience as we work through the previous panels, and glad to have you here. As you're getting settled, one comment I hope everybody will take in the light-hearted mood that it's intended. I'm having some second thoughts. This is the Sustainability and Economic Development Committee, and the amount of paper that we've accumulated here makes me think twice. Please go ahead.
Welcome to the fish world.
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Brigham. I am chair of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. I am also an elected leader for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I am the board secretary. I've been on fish issues since 1976. I have seen a lot of things, and I want to congratulate you for taking this approach in trying to learn about the salmon information. It's very complex. It's very complicated. I mean, there's a lot of interest here for salmon. Salmon is the backbone to many of us, to the Columbia River. It's the way our way of life, our culture, and our economics. I just have to let you know that I thought it was really interesting when they said science is simple. I can remember when a decision was made that it was based on science, that it was best to put the fish below Bonneville Dam. And that was based on science because it was simple. And we all know that decision was wrong. It was a decision that eliminated salmon from going above Bonneville Dam. And so even though people are saying it's based on the best available science, and science is simple, it's how you look at it. You have to look at it for the resources. You have to be planning for the future. There are many obligations within the Columbia River. Our tribal treaty rights is one of them, and we've gone to court to protect those tribal treaty rights, and we will continue to go to court to protect those treaty rights, because that's our livelihood, our culture, our way of life. Like I said, I've been involved since 1976. I've seen many, many different areas. I've seen the fish fights, the fish wars. I've been at conferences where there were petitions to say, save the salmon, can in Indian down with old trees, all of those types of things. I have also seen partnership and collaboration, and it works. It really works. I mean, Bonneville Power, when they were doing the Power Act, it was the salmon people who got together who said the Power Act has to look at salmon mitigation. And it was the salmon people who worked together to make sure that the Power Act, when it was passed, was looking at mitigation for salmon. It was the salmon people who got together when we passed the Pacific Salmon Treaty, who says we're going to pass work together to bring salmon back to the Columbia River. It was just amazing to see all of us working together. And yes, we don't always agree. But we don't always disagree either when we are looking at the future, when we are looking at how we can protect our salmon for the next seven generations. And that's the tribe's goal, is looking at the next seven generations. And I'm proud to say some of the non-Indian people are saying the same thing. I thought it was very interesting who some of the people were up here testifying were also some of the same people who worked with us side by side in trying to protect, restore, and enhance our salmon. We have worked as tribal leaders for a government-to-government approach for many, many years. And so if any legislation were to pass, I think it's really important that you remember that we have treaty rights on the Columbia River. We have to be consulted. We need to be consulted to look at the possible impacts that it has to our treaty rights. Because if it has a negative impact to our treaty rights, we will be in court. We have just adopted a USV Oregon management plan. It's a 10-year management plan, and we spent a long time working on that on that agreement. And in that agreement is a 50-50 allocation, which is consistent with the federal court decision of 1969. That allocation states that tribes get 50%, states get 50%, and we have chosen to not get involved in whether that goes to state or to recreational fishermen or sports fishermen or commercial fishermen. But at the same time, we are very much concerned about if current situations change and the impact that it has on the allocation, we will get involved, because we are working to live up to the court agreement, our treaty rights, that says we have the right to 50-50 allocation. And in the past, quite frankly, we have been overfished by sportsmen and commercial fishermen both. But it has happened, and we don't want to see it happen again. We work annually with ODF&W, well, the parties to USV Oregon through the compact, to look at the fishing regimes, to see how many fish are available, to see what is going for escapement, and to see how we are going to harvest. We also look at the mortality rates, you know, how many fish are killed through the dams by sports fishermen, by gill netters, by us. I mean, we look at all of these things before a fishing regime is adopted, or before harvest numbers are agreed to, and once they've been agreed to, then we decide how we're going to harvest those. So our partnerships with the states has been very good through the USB Oregon process. I think, you know, it's really important to say that the TAC Advisory Committee and the PAC Advisory Committee under the USV Oregon process is made up of science people, our science people, who are co-managers of the resources. And as co-managers, we are looking out for the resource as a whole and how we're going to protect, restore, and enhance our salmon. We have an agreement. We want to work to implement that agreement, and we hope that you know, you will support us working together through collaboration and partnership, as we have done in reaching that agreement to implement what we've agreed to. I have a written statement, and I think I've given it to you, but I think the main thing is, again, we want to make sure that any action you take here at this table is takes into consideration the tribes and the impact that it has on the tribes as it pertains to our allocation. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Although I can talk for 10 more minutes if you want me to.
I think you've done a nice job setting things up. Okay. Thank you very much. Sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Only Pat Jr. I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I was just recently the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Prior to that, I was chairman of the Tribal Council at Warm Springs and a member of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. I currently serve as a commissioner appointed by President Bush to the Pacific Salmon Commission. I represent the tribes of the Columbia River, Puget Sound, and Western Washington. The one thing that I spent a good deal of my life with salmon. So one thing I found out that is that, you know, there are no single fixes to this problem. Salmon management is a very, very complicated matter, and it's complicated even by species. You know, coho are less complicated than chinook. Chinook are multi-jurisdictional. We just concluded renegotiating the Chinook chapter of the Pacific Salmon Treaty that was concluded in May, and all of the other chapters were negotiated by panels of stakeholders. However, the Chinook chapter was booted up to the full commission just because you have Alaska, you have Canada, Washington, Oregon, Puget Sound, the Columbia River. Now, I want to address a couple of things that have been brought up here, and these have been rolled out as cure-alls for the protection of wild fish, mass marking and marked selective fisheries. Now, on its face, that looks like a very, very good solution to a complex problem. However, mass marking and marked selective fisheries is a double-edged sword. If you want to focus in on just the Columbia, this might look like a really good solution. However, if mass marking uses an adipose clip, most fish that fish that were adipose clipped had a coated wire tag in their nose. That coated wire tag was collected by fishermen in Alaska and Canada. And the resulting information told fisheries managers where the fish were being caught, where they came from, what the brood year was, and so on. The fact that we're flooding the waters with marked fish that don't have coated wire tags is endangering the integrity of that management program. Recently, the Pacific Salmon Commission impaneled a group, an expert panel, on coated wire tags. They concluded that the coated wire tag is the best management tool we have now for ocean fisheries. The result of the fisheries being flooded by non-coated wire tag fish is that you don't have any more buy-in from the Canadians and the Alaskans. It's a very expensive thing to take the snout off a fish, send it in, and have it tested. So Canada, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, is less likely to mandate that their fishers sample. The smaller sample size means that we have less of a handle on what's happening to our fish out there. The largest harvest of Columbia River fish takes place in the ocean. You have three major fisheries that hit our fishery, hit our salmon. These are called aggregate abundance-based management areas: Southeast Alaska, Northern British Columbia, the west coast of Vancouver Island. We just concluded an agreement where we got Southeast Alaska to reduce their fishery by 15%, West Coast Vancouver Island by 30%. But what they do is they fish on an aggregate, on an abundance index. If you're flooding the waters with hatchery fish, you're driving that abundance index up. The abundance index ignores weak stocks. So those fish that are we're trying to protect in the Columbia River are not being protected under that kind of regime. So, like I said, it's a double-edged sword. You've got to take all of those things into consideration. One thing I've learned in this business, if you push on this balloon one place, it pops out someplace else. So, you know, I would urge you to use caution in how you approach fisheries management. I fully agree with the gentleman from the Lower River Columbia, gill netters, who said, if you ban gill nets in the Columbia River, what you're doing is you're just reallocating those fish, because fish are managed based on based on escapement. If you take away one fishery, you're opening it up for another.
Thank you very much. I especially appreciate your analogy with the balloon. That seems especially apt. It looks like we have a couple of minutes if there are questions, just to conclude here. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was struck by the consensus among those who testified today that all groups have a concern for the fish stocks and that they be recovered in the most appropriate manner possible. And I know that Ms. Brigham has been involved in a number of tribal groups at the federal level, where it brings a lot of fishers together with a common purpose. And I was wondering if she could relate for us the success that that she's experienced in bringing different groups together with a common purpose of, in essence, increasing the size of the pie, the more fish.
Yes, that happened. Thank you, Representative Witt. That happened in 1980s, where we were working. It was the Pacific Salmon Treaty. We were negotiating with Canada, Alaska, the states of Oregon and Washington to reach an agreement on ocean management, on how we would manage the ocean fisheries. For many time, many years, in fact, the state, sports fishermen, the recreational fishermen, and the tribes were not in agreement. But this is one issue where we all came to agreement with, and the basis was, if we can reach an agreement with Canada to get more fish back to the U.S., we'll have more fish. And it was really good to see the sports fishermen, the commercial fishermen from both states of Oregon, Washington, and even it's Oregon and Washington, and then the tribes, the 24 tribes from Oregon and Washington and Idaho, the states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, get together to say, you know, we have a common goal. We need to protect and restore our salmon. And so it was really good to go to Congress in the 85, 84 area and say, you know, we have an agreement. Salmon people are working together to protect our salmon. And we were able to persuade Congress to pass the legislation needed to support the U.S.-Canada Treaty. So it was really good. It happens. It can happen again. But we just need your guys' support to say you guys need to work together to figure out how we're going to develop a plan for salmon. As you've heard from so many people today, I mean, we're all interested in salmon. We want salmon for the next seven generations, but we need to develop an overall plan. And like JP was saying, is that you push the balloon, it's going to come out someplace. And salmon is very complex. I mean, in-stream flow is something we're working to protect. Habitat, there's so many issues there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and that might be a good note on which to conclude. I again really appreciate what you said, Representative Witt and Ms. Brigham, the concept of seven generations. Despite the varied perspectives we've heard today, it seems like that's a good place from which we can all start. And I also would suspect that, though this is the beginning of the conversation, it is probably not the end. We have more work to do and more conversation to have. Appreciate everyone's participation, good comments, and the tone which we set here of respect and careful consideration of varied perspectives. Unless anyone else has any general comments, for the good of the order, I'll close the informational meeting on Lower Columbia River Fish Management and the committee. Thank you.